Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 97-year-old Les Doyle of Strathmore, California. I want to thank one of our listeners named Bill Bruno for letting me know about his friend Les and his unique story. Les was the first member of his family of 10 to join the military, and he headed to the Pacific Theater in 1944. Had you ever been on a ship before?
No, I hadn't been on a huge cruiser or anything, no. Just small lake boats.
So how'd you handle that long trip across the ocean to the Pacific?
The first thing you have to get used to is the momentum of the vessel, and because a lot of fellows absorb seasickness. I didn't experience any because I tried to work with the roll of the ship and things like that, so I can't say that I ever experienced what some of the fellows had in seasickness.
And where did you go?
My first deployment out of San Francisco was New Guinea. And then the next deployment was Lingayen Gulf on the Big Island of the Philippines. And then I went to Leyte, and the Philippine Islands was the main thing of where I was.
Well, let's take them one by one and explore that a little bit. So your first taste of things after this long journey across the ocean was in New Guinea, where they'd been fighting for a little bit by the time you got there. What kinds of things did you see or do there in New Guinea?
I had just turned 19 years old, and things like the war there was totally something new to me. I was taught to be a hard worker and experience anything that comes about, try to handle any situation. And so I just went on and did my job, and where a lot of fellas, they were in turmoil, didn't really know what to do.
And how well did you know the guys that you were serving with?
Well, now, whenever once you left the States and got over to the islands and things, then you were amongst strangers. You had to be mentally adaptable to get along with most any person, that regardless of how their feelings were about things, go on and do your job that you were called to do.
Did you get to do some of your job there at New Guinea, or was that just a quick pit stop on the way to the Philippines?
The jungles of New Guinea was totally different from anything I'd ever experienced. The jungle life, the first thing I thought about was these huge trees and these vines hanging down, and I thought about Tarzan, you know, growing up and hearing all the stories about Tarzan and whatnot. Well, that's the impression of these trees and their vines and whatnot. That was the first thing I thought about.
But you didn't go swinging on them?
No way.
And you didn't meet Jane?
Nope.
What other eye-opening things did you see there in the time you were in New Guinea?
Well, there were so many, animals, that unusual animals that like I wasn't accustomed to. Like I had a big GMC truck, and I was going down through the jungle there in New Guinea, pushing down these trees 3 and 4 inches big in diameter to make my own path through there. I was told about where to go, but there was no way to go there, only feel it out and find your way. Well, you know, when you when you see something that looks like an alligator coming up to your front wheel, no doors on the truck cab or anything, and you see this thing coming up there, you think it's a big alligator, but it's a huge lizard, looked as big as alligators. Uh-huh. And I was pushing down these trees, making my own path. I was told where to go to find some nipa, cut nipa for rain diversion, temporary roofs, like, you know, to cut down some of the residue. When you're going through the jungle like that, though, and you got no door on your vehicle, and you see these things coming at you or whatnot, first one I seen, I jumped straight up out of my seat. But getting used to the jungle was a little different way of life. I was the type that I tried to adapt to whatever my situation was.
So in that time period on New Guinea. I mean, you're telling us what your job is, the things you had to do. Was there any concern that enemy fire could come in, that there could be shells lobbed your way or planes going over bombing or enemy soldiers in the jungle?
Oh, well, we had Japanese suicide planes coming in all the time, and that's what you had, kamikaze, they called them. They spotted you or something or other, and they wanted to bomb you. Why, here they come. And so if one of our planes didn't knock them down before they got to you, you'd be in trouble.
Well, and I think we're going to hear about a situation like that a little later on for you in the Philippines. But is there anything else about your time in New Guinea that stands out that is important to note?
No, New Guinea was a total new experience. You know, all of these different animals, I couldn't even tell you what they all are or whatnot, you know, because New Guinea was uninhabited, so to speak, more or less, you know. The animal species just kind of thrived.
A little different wildlife than Tarabella, huh?
You bet.
And just so I'm clear, did you guys end up establishing some communication posts there on New Guinea? Were you able to set up some radio or telephone lines, or what'd you do?
Telephone lines is what we were involved with, and stringing wire and trying to, because that was our, it had walkie-talkies for short distance and whatnot, but if you had to string miles or whatnot, rather like that, it was a running wire. And then we had a lot of problems with running wire on the ground. Why, then we had sniper problems, clipping the wire someplace. And then you had to, at nighttime, you'd have to go find that break in the line. And that was kind of scary because it was just the snipers that, you know, did that.
And if the snipers can interrupt the line, then they can shoot you too, huh?
That's right, you bet. So we had to be careful about that nighttime searching for breaking the line.
Well, that brings up a few more questions. One, did you ever have any close calls with sniper fire?
Well, yes, you know, particularly if you had to turn on your flashlight just for an instant or something or other. You think you've found something or other, but it's too dark to visually see, and so you've got your flashlight. It lends in a sense that just gives you a little bit of view, but being a dark, why, it doesn't take much light for you to be able to see something. So when you're searching for a break at nighttime, why, you had to be careful because there was more sniper fire.
And how do you find a break in the line in the dark, in the jungle, with snipers ready to shoot you if you show too much light? I mean, how do you actually go through the process of deciphering where that break in the line is?
Well, you go so far and you check the line, and if the line's dead, then you go on until you pick the line up and hang a tester on it and see if it goes on. And that's the way you have to chase down. We had no tools that that told you where the break was or anything rather like that. You had to find it.
And I'm just trying to put myself in your shoes. That sounds a little bit nerve-wracking.
Well, you're cautious about what you're trying to do, but you have to be diligent too, or you'll never find it.
So it's probably a pretty good feeling when you finally do find it.
That's right. When you find your break, why, oh boy, this is okay. You're ready to splice the line.
But I'm just guessing, and I could be wrong. There are probably situations where you find one break and fix it and then realize there's another break too, so you have more work to do?
Oh, yes. That was a common factor there where you had snipers and whatnot. You never know where they're going to clip the line, and your line was your life source. So you needed to find whatever the problem was and try to fix it.
Yeah, and I guess another question that comes to mind as you're describing that, is that something that you would do by yourself? Did you have someone going with you? How did that work?
Well, not always did you go out in pairs. You had to go out by yourself, you know, a lot of different times. There wasn't someone else to help you. You just had to go out and find the source of the trouble.
And you go from New Guinea to the Philippines, and you said you made a stop before the famous landing with MacArthur at Leyte in October of 44?
Yeah, I went to Port Legazpi, stopped at Port Legazpi on the southern end of the Big Island, and then the Lingayen Gulf, which was up around the Baguio area. Those were the two areas where I spent the most of my time on the Big Island.
Doing the same kinds of things, or were there some new experiences there?
No, you had a routine of what you needed to do, and so that's wherever you were searching for whatever, you knew automatically what you needed to do when you found it.
And of course, you know, a lot of people know the history. There might be some people listening who don't, but at the start of the war, we had a lot of troops in the Philippines. Later on, they would be undersupplied and cut off. A lot of them would end up prisoners of war if they survived the Bataan Death March. And General MacArthur famously escaped from Corregidor with his family. But he said, "I shall return." And you got to be there when he returned.
I was with MacArthur when his group returned. When he told the Filipino people, "I'll return," and I just happened to be in his group when he returned to the Philippines.
And if you go to that spot now, there's actually a statue of him and others wading ashore as they did. And I've had some guys talk about, well, he probably didn't really need to wade ashore. They could have taken him all the way to dry land, but he wanted to be a little dramatic. You tell me, you were there, I wasn't. What did you see and experience?
I would say they experienced waters up to knee-deep getting into when they'd get off of either the boat or the barge or whatever. And sometimes they'd be on a barge and the barge would go aground, so they had to get out and wade ashore. And MacArthur had to do that, too. When you're in a situation like that of war, you do whatever you need to do.
And so is that something you actually saw in real time, or you saw the newsreel footage of it later because you were on another ship in that group?
No, I waded ashore with MacArthur's group there on October 20. I was with the group. That's a great day in history, October morning of October 20, and I was there with MacArthur and his group.
So tell me about it. Was that as big a deal at the time as it seems to be now? Did you understand the significance of that?
I wouldn't say that I understood all the significance of it. To me, I was just trying to do what needed to be done at the time and do my job.
So what'd you have to do there?
Well, my job of action has always been communication, keeping the lines open.
So you guys come ashore there, and it's the same thing. You're going into the jungle to string telephone line and make sure they can communicate?
Yes. We just try to do whatever your job was, just try to do it the best you can.
Well, and when I showed up at your house here in Strathmore, the first thing I noticed was your big sparkling photo from when you went to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight in April of 2015 and all you guys in front of the National World War II Memorial. The next thing I saw was a P-38, and I was trying to figure out, why is there a P-38? You weren't in the Army Air Corps. What is going on here? And then I realized this entire metal sculpture here is made out of bullets, different calibers. The stand is one caliber and the twin fuselage is a different caliber. I'll put a picture of this at hometownheroesradio.com, but you made that little sculpture for a very special reason. Tell me the story behind that.
Well, one day when I was searching for breaking a line, there wasn't a group around or anything. I was sort of by myself searching the line. And then I hear a plane coming and look up and here's a Zero pursuing in my direction. So what's going to happen? Am I going to get bombed out? But before that Zero had the opportunity to get to me, here come a P-38 out of the clouds, and that was the end of that Zero. So this P-38 pilot saved my life literally right there on the spot. And so I'm a creator of different objects and whatnot. I just had to create this little miniature P-38 as a little memory of what happened that day, a tribute to the P-38 pilot.
And, you know, I'm not trying to be melodramatic about it, but there are a lot of questions that arise because I just heard you say that he saved your life, and I could tell that still stirs some emotions for you. You know, this is almost 80 years later now. So if that P-38 hadn't been there, what do you think would have happened?
I wouldn't have made it home. That's in plain English. I'd been a few fragments left there from the plane.
So you think the plane would have dropped a bomb, destroyed the work that you were doing and you?
Yeah, or machine gun me, you know, down.
So before that P-38 came out, and I realize this may be seconds we're talking about, the span of time, but what was going through your mind when you saw the Japanese plane coming your way? Because there's not a lot you can do, is there?
No, you know, I have the good Lord on my side, so I'm not one to fret a lot or whatnot. I was there to do a job and I was trying to do it. And if this plane comes in there and bombs or shoots at me, whatever, so be it. That was my job to do, and I was going to do it the best I could.
Yeah. And again, I realize this can transpire in a matter of seconds, but I'm just curious for you. Is there a thought, well, I need to try to take cover? Do you sit there and say a prayer? Are you scared? I'm just wondering about the emotions involved.
Well, the emotions you have in a situation like that, a person like me that has a good solid ground to cling to, whatever comes about, comes about. You're there and you're at their mercy. So unless somebody comes along to assist you, why, you're in trouble.
So the other half of that is, what did it feel like when you saw that P-38 Lightning come out of nowhere to shoot the Japanese plane down?
I just took a deep breath because I was so grateful and thankful, and that's the reason that I created this miniature P-38 out of bullets to constantly remind me through life of what that plane pilot did for me.
How long ago do you think it was that you made that?
Oh, I made it. I brought these shell pieces home from the war, and I got right onto it as soon as I got home.
So these shells are from World War II, and you've had that?
These shells home from the war, yes. And the trouble I had trying to construct a little plane like this, I just had the old family soldering iron to heat it. Well, with this copper and brass and whatnot, I'd heat one area there, and my anchor lead would run out another spot because the heat transferred so in that. And so I had a little problem creating my plane.
Well, it's still standing. It has stood the test of time. And we'll put a little photo and a video of Mr. Doyle telling that story at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for you. Have you ever wondered who that pilot was or what happened to him the rest of the war?
No, I can't say as I did because he got away at that point, so that was the end of my connection to that. I was so grateful that he come in, though, and knocked that other plane, that Zero plane, out of the way and saved my life. Yep. That's what credit him for, was saving my life.
And we do have a picture of Les with that unique memento he made, as well as a short video about it. That's on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, as well as hometownheroesradio.com. Another video you'll find there features Les showing us the 50 classic Chevrolets he restored in his retirement. We'll hear how that came about when we come back, and also about Les's honor flight to Washington, D.C. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.